Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your host for this evening. We welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Leslie Berlin. Leslie Berlin is a project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford University. She has been a fellow at the Center for Advanced Studies in the Behavioral Sciences and served on the advisory committee to the Lemelson Center for the Study of Invention and Innovation at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. She received her PhD in history from Stanford University and her BA in American Studies from Yale. She is also the author of the book, Troublemakers, How Silicon Valley is Coming of Age. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Leslie Berlin.
Thank you all for coming on such a gray and rainy day. I'm very excited to be here. It's always a thrill for me to come up from suburban Palo Alto to the beautiful city of San Francisco, which, as the tech industry has spread north, is something I've been doing more and more. So what I want to do tonight is talk with you about a remarkable period in American history that not enough people know about. It's an amazing seven-year period that I actually think rivals the Italian Renaissance for its creativity and its impact. And it happens in the United States in the 1970s, right here, right down the road, actually. I mean, typically when we think of the United States in the 1970s, the thoughts are pretty dark. This is the New York Times from the day that President Nixon resigns in the wake of Watergate. We think of a country absolutely in crisis. Here are the gas pumps being empty at the time of the gas crisis and oil shocks in the 1970s. And of course, the country was absolutely torn asunder by the Vietnam War and clashes among generations. And this incredibly dramatic picture of a man being clubbed by law enforcement is actually taken at Berkeley during the People's Park protests in 1969. And in Silicon Valley, though, at the same time, these years marked a time of great technical innovation. This is a picture, for example, of the Alto, which was sort of the first personal computer that looked like what we would think of as a personal computer from 1977. And what you see during this period of time that starts in 1969 and goes through the 70s is Silicon Valley transforming itself from this place really that was gearhead engineers selling microchips to other gearhead engineers into the birthplace of five major industries that are absolutely influencing our lives today down to the deepest levels. I mean, the announcement to turn off your cell phone just shows we don't go anywhere without this tech in our pockets. In the space of the years 69 to 76, you see the birth of Apple, Genentech, Atari, Kleiner Perkins, Sequoia Capital. Those are two major venture capital firms. The first internet transmission, at that point it was called the ARPANET, comes into SRI on the Stanford campus. Stanford begins licensing its intellectual property from its faculty, staff, and students to the wider world. This is really the time when ideas that had been sort of locked up in university labs and defense department labs started to make their way out to the rest of us. This is when Intel invents the microprocessor, the computer on a chip, and it's also the time that Silicon Valley organizations really start to pursue lobbying in Washington. This is when you're seeing the birth of the National Venture Capital Association, the Semiconductor Industry Associations. These become huge forces shaping sort of political decisions even today. And so it's a tough question. How do you try to tell all of these stories in the space of a single book? And if you look at my book, you say, I see how you did it. It looks really fat. to which I would say, I still have my PhD, and this is a deeply researched book. The last 100 pages of the book are footnotes. But I have buried them deep, so the storytelling, I hope, comes all the way through. And the way I decided to do this was try to find individuals, ideally unknown or unknown outside of the sort of cognoscenti, and who had done something important, somehow changed the way that we live, and made a real impact, and I called them the troublemakers. And so for most of this talk, I'll tell you who these seven people are. But first, I wanted to show you Silicon Valley before this book opens, before the 1970s. There were no Google buses, of course, and Highway 101 was brand new, but this is what Silicon Valley looked like at the time. This is actually 1950. These are pear orchards on the land that is now the Intel building, actually. And it's funny because my first book was about Bob Noyce, who's a co-founder of Intel. And I read and heard from employees who would tell these stories about how while the campus was being built, they would go out and pick pears on the property. And I thought, that sounds like one of those legends that actually isn't quite true, because everyone knows that Silicon Valley was all about apricots and plums and stone fruits. They didn't grow pears. But literally 6 months ago, a woman contacted me and said, I have something for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford, which is where I work and where we welcome, actually, donations related to the history of Silicon Valley. And she said, this is a picture of the pear orchard that my family owned. And these were she only knew the size of her own family's plot, which is at the bottom of the picture here, but that alone was 90 acres. This was a pear orchard that was established in 1867 and was sold to Intel, actually, almost exactly 100 years later. One thing I really want to point out to you is in the upper left corner of this picture, you see Moffett Field. So that ought to help to situate you a little bit. And the road, that narrow road kind of running in front of Moffett Field is 101, actually, what 101 looked like at that time. And I want to point out Moffett Field in part because I want you to understand how important the federal government and particularly the Department of Defense was in establishing Silicon Valley, the generation before the generation that I'm talking about. The story of the 1950s and 1960s is really about these microchips being sold for defense purposes. Literally 100% of the first microchips were sold to the Department of Defense. Lockheed was the biggest employer in Silicon Valley. And people were, if these companies weren't directly selling to the Department of Defense, so for example, Hewlett-Packard famously didn't want to do direct government contracting. Nonetheless, they were selling to subcontractors, and a huge portion of their sales went to the Department of Defense, which made perfect sense because the DOD was willing to pay anything for something that was smaller, lighter, more reliable. In effect, they served as the equivalent of venture capitalists funding the sort of research that got us going. But during the 1970s, the attitude in the Valley really shifted away from the notion of the Department of Defense. I'm talking about the people who come to work in the Valley. Away from the notion that the Department of Defense was our best source of safety and security in the war against the Cold War, into the notion of this is the place that got us into the quagmire that was the Vietnam War. And I think think that the Vietnam War really needs to be understood in its importance, not just for its cultural significance, but also it had very real practical impacts, by which I mean, up until the 1970s, if you were a graphics expert or you were an engineer with a specialization in semiconductor electronics, you absolutely would have gone to work for the Department of Defense. But a lot of these people instead chose to work for companies like Atari, which we all think of as sort of this funny little video game company, which of course it was. It also had an incredible array of graphics experts working there who deliberately did not want to work for the Department of Defense. Also, this very much the same thing happened at Xerox PARC. And in the same way that the Valley at this time is really quite unrecognizable today, before the 1970s, the same is true for the tech of the time. This is a 1969 Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog, and it's an advertisement for a kitchen computer. So it goes up to the waist of the housewife who is storing her recipes on it. And computers at this point really were just a completely abstract idea. They were the unknown, incomprehensible piece of machinery at the back of your bank's office that screwed up your checking account every month. They cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that was for the newest, cheapest ones, and they were pretty much confined to banks, airlines, universities. And it was totally absurd to think that you were going to have a computer in your home. So I want to point out to you, the price of this computer is $10,600 in 1969. So that's roughly 70 grand today. You could buy a Tesla. And I don't know the specs on this machine, but I can tell you it is less sophisticated than your Nest thermostat. And I also want to point out, of course, that this is the... Here is an example of a woman in computing, and it's something that we'll talk about a little later. There were women who were working as engineers. They were working as game designers. I profile a woman who was CEO of a company. At the same time, women were used to sell all of this tech for the same reason that women have been used to sell things for a long time. Sex appeal. Also, computers had their own little interesting edge, which was IBM, for example, and its flagship Manhattan offices deliberately put women in the front window and explained that they believed that if men walking by saw women using the computers, they would think they were easy to use. So it's just a very, very different time. And just to give you one more data point on how impractical and exotic computers were at the time, you could buy two of the following for the same price in your Neiman Marcus catalog as this computer. Two elephants, two baby elephants cost exactly the same as that kitchen computer. No computer sold, and I don't know how many elephants sold. And so to ask yourself, okay, how do you get from the time when the valley's covered with orchards, where computers are this exotic thing as crazy as elephants, to that sort of giant, it's almost like watching the Big Bang during these 9 years, 8, 9 years that I look at. And I want to show you the seven people who I profile to try to get a handle on how this happened. So here's the first person. You'll recognize the person on the left, undoubtedly, is Steve Jobs. Just a show of hands, how many people recognize the person on the right? Okay, I'm going to just call on someone. Yeah, yell it out. Right, Mike Markola. So that's Mike Markola on the right. For the record, about five hands went up in the room of, what, about 30-some-odd people. So Mike is virtually unknown outside of Silicon Valley. I mean, the very, very knowledgeable people of early Silicon Valley history. Mike Markola owned a third of Apple. The other two-thirds, one-third was owned by Steve Jobs and one-third was owned by Steve Wozniak. So that gives you some sense of his importance in starting this company. Mike was 34 years old when he retired from Intel as a multimillionaire, having managed to convince them that instead of the 1,000 stock options that they normally gave to engineers, he wanted 11,000 stock options, and this was before the IPO. So this helped him have a great deal of independence, and he set out to have a what he called office hours, basically, for young entrepreneurs. After he'd gotten a little bit tired of playing tennis all the time and he was having a wonderful life building furniture, he decided that he wanted to go ahead and work with some entrepreneurs. And his pal, Don Valentine, who's the founder of Sequoia Capital, came by and said, there are these two guys, they're working in a garage. I think they could use some help. And they absolutely could use some help because Steve Jobs was 21 years old. He had had a total of 17 months of work experience in his entire life as a tech for Atari. He was not the person who was going to be able to do what happened with Apple, which was it was the youngest company ever to make it into the Fortune 500. And Steve Wozniak, meanwhile, was a full-time engineer at HP. That was his dream job. He would have been happy to stay in that job forever. Markula only convinced him to come over to Apple full-time after a friend of Steve Wozniak's told him that he would never have to manage. He could just be an engineer. And that was good enough for Wozniak. So what Markula did, he'd been at Intel in the ramp up. He'd been at Fairchild Semiconductor, which was the first successful semiconductor company in Silicon Valley. And he had really seen how a tiny company becomes a powerhouse. And he built the entire business infrastructure around the Apple II. So if you look at Apple's S-1 for their IPO in 1980, you'll see that the president of Apple, the vice president of manufacturing, the vice president of marketing, the vice president of sales, their CFO, their major investors, Sequoia Capital, Venrock, and Arthur Rock, all of them came to Apple through Mike Markula. And as a matter of fact, the VP of sales and the VP of manufacturing, who also was the president of Apple at the time, had shared an office about the size of this stage back in about 1966 when they all worked together at Fairchild Semiconductor. So Mike is one of these hidden stories in Silicon Valley, and there's so many of them, of people who, as the myths, I would say, have grown up. The reality behind it sometimes gets lost. And I think especially if you're someone like Mike, who, I mean, he loved things like, I'm going to create the best sales logistics system ever. I mean, he loved the minutia of business. Without that, Apple never, ever could have ramped up the way it did. You can look at companies that failed because nobody knew where their products were in the supply chain. No one had what they needed at the time. Mike made sure the place just ran like clockwork. So Mike Markle is one of the people I talk about. Another person I talk about is very different, and I can guarantee, well, actually, I think there's one person in the room who does know who this is. This is Fawn Alvarez on her first day of work. She is 18 years old. She is dressed like Minnie Mouse because it's Halloween. And she is about to begin work on the manufacturing line at Rolm, which built initially, it's a great example of what I'm talking about. Rolm starts out building computers, military grade computers for Department of Defense and others, and ends up selling, in addition, very sophisticated Rolm phone systems. Probably a lot of people in this room had on their desks, you know, the Rolm phones. There was a big debate for a long time whether the phone or the computer was going to be the center of the office of the future. So Fawn's story is fascinating because she goes from being working on the assembly line to being effectively the chief of staff to the president of IBM Rolm after IBM acquires Rolm in the mid-1980s. And Fawn's story reveals something really important about Silicon Valley, which is it used to be a manufacturing region. whenever people want to understand why is it that San Francisco has suddenly become such an important part of the tech economy in the Bay Area, because it always played a role, but more or less on the financial side for the most part. You know, some venture capitalists up here, some important banks up here. But the reason that San Francisco has moved to where it is in the tech economy is because of the rise of software. It used to be that these companies all had to build products, and they had to actually have honest-to-God factories with assembly lines where people, almost all of them women, sat and assembled boards or assembled computers. You needed an enormous amount of space to get that done. And Fawn didn't go to college. Her mother, who had a similar career trajectory, actually, didn't even finish high school. But they were able to buy houses in Silicon Valley because of the combination of there being very good middle-class jobs, manufacturing jobs in the Valley, and also because there were really a lot of forward-thinking, progressive companies, Rome sort of foremost among them, that did things like, I believe it was after 7 years of work, you got a 3-month fully paid sabbatical, that everyone in the company could buy reduced price stock. There wasn't a benefit for the executive suite that didn't go down to the manufacturing line, except for stock options. Those were reserved for the professionals. But nonetheless, you had people throughout the organization really benefiting from the success of the organization. And even over the course of the time that I look at, you start seeing the manufacturing move. It's moving, at first it's moving to Oregon, it's moving to New Mexico. The chips have already started to move to Asia. And so you see this change happening, and you see, I quote the president of Hewlett-Packard, wringing his hands, saying, I'm afraid this is going to become a place only for the rich and the well-educated. They see what's happening and really are having a difficult time figuring out what to do about it. So that's Fawn Alvarez. This is Niels Reimers. He is the person who convinced Stanford to start licensing its intellectual property. He started something called the Office of Technology Licensing at Stanford. And at first I thought, okay, how interesting is this possibly going to be? And honestly, I also thought, how many unrelated things do I have to learn here? I mean, now I have to learn about intellectual property law. But luckily I have friends who were able to fact check me on all of these different sections. But in some ways, I feel like I wrote 6 books and then stuck them between 2 covers. But I think what makes the book interesting is all of the overlaps, where you'll have, excuse me, you'll have something like Don Valentine, who was the venture capitalist who put Mike Markle in touch with the Apple guys, also be the guy who's funding the startup of Atari. They are all working in each other's buildings all the time. There's this weird sort of cooperative / competitive aspect to what's happening. And at Stanford, the changes are somewhat slow in coming. So when Niels Reimers asks in 1970, what do we do with these releases when we get information from the scientists and others at Stanford telling us, they give us an invention disclosure, what do we do with these? He was told, oh, you send them off to New York. So in the 13 years previous to Niels Reimers' arrival at Stanford and his creation of the Office of Technology Licensing, Stanford had brought in a total of $3,000 from the intellectual property of its faculty and staff over 13 years. So that's about $260 a year.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Today, Stanford has brought in that Office of Technology Licensing is at $2 billion that has come into the university. The Office of Technology Licensing is the place, and it's Niels Reimers was the guy who heard about the recombinant DNA process and said, that seems like something that we ought to be able to license, and worked with UCSF, which had a co-inventor there named Herb Boyer, to come up with a way to patent this idea. It was a radical idea to patent this, and a super interesting story. And the pushback that he faced was incredible, because Stanford and these scientists themselves are saying, you know, how is this going to work? It's the job of the university to try to increase the overall store of knowledge in the world. And now you're saying we're going to charge people for this. How's that going to work? So there were all of these rules around, you know, educational institutions didn't need to pay, researchers didn't need to pay. Niels really believed, and a lot of people believe this actually, that these ideas are much more likely to be used if they actually are patented and put out in the world. And I don't want to have that debate tonight, but it's a viable debate whether or not that's true. And this is a picture of the co-founders of Genentech, which is the story that sort of I tell that blends into the Office of Technology Licensing, the birth of the biotech industry. People hear Silicon Valley, they really don't think biotech, but absolutely that was here too, started here too. Genentech, another company called Cetus, whose papers we have at Stanford, this was vitally important and built right on top of the same sorts of entrepreneurial ecosystems that had been set up first for the chip guys and then for people like the personal computer people. They folded right in. So the major early backer of Genentech was Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers, which also backed Tandem Computers back in the day and was founded by yet another person who came out of Fairchild Semiconductor, Eugene Kleiner, and someone who'd come out of Hewlett-Packard. So again, everything is sort of layered on top of each other. So this is Herb Boyer on the left, Bob Swanson on the right. Herb Boyer was the science guy, and Bob Swanson was the business guy. And again, the resistance these people faced is something I think that now we look at the pushback that we're experiencing in Silicon Valley, because Silicon Valley is right now in a lot of people's bullseyes in a way that it hadn't been, I would say has never been before in such a systematic way. But parts had been, and one of those really was biotech. Biotech scared the heck out of people. The notion that you could swap genes from one species into another and then they would start reproducing. I mean, literally the mayor of Cambridge, Massachusetts publicly said that he had gotten calls from constituents about an orange-eyed monster near the Harvard campus, and could this be due to the biotech research happening on the campus? And actually, a future Nobel Prize winner was forced to go to England to do his research because it was so contentious. And just to give you a sense of this, these are protesters holding a sign that says, "We will create the perfect race, Adolf Hitler." And these are protesters interrupting a meeting of the National Academy of Sciences in 1977. So this was a scientific panel discussing the merits and dangers of recombinant DNA research. And so another industry that also faced this kind of pushback, though not to this degree, actually, was the video game industry. And I had to show you this picture because this is so similar to the kitchen computer picture. This game is Computer Space. This is the first video game to come out of a company that was originally called Zysigy and then became Atari. And this was seen as so cool and futuristic, and it is actually very beautiful machine. It was in the movie Soylent Green as sort of a sign of kind of what the future would look like. And again, a woman is selling it with her arm draped over the side. The video game industry got its start in and was perceived as part of a super seedy world. So it was the world of gambling. So it was classed with pinball machines, and pinball machines were, I believe it was illegal in New York and just about to be declared legal, or had just been declared legal in Chicago, or the other way around. I don't remember. But they were seen as games of chance because you could win a free game, right, if you played it well. And so the pinball machines, their territories were largely controlled by mob bosses, along with, interestingly, jukebox machines. And the video games got classed into that exact same group, along with they were also seen as extremely at a lot of these conferences and such that the early video game people would go to. There would be like special booths. They almost looked like phone booths where men could watch movies in privacy, and their, you know, their easy cleanup would be described as a feature of these booths. And so it was just super duper seedy at the time. The people in the video game industry would talk about having guns pulled on them by, you know, bosses who felt like their territories were being infringed on. Really seedy. So this is Atari's first really famous video game, and actually the one that brought video games to kind of a broader public. This is Pong. And this shows the co-founders, Ted Dabney on the left of the machine, Nolan Bushnell on the right. This is another story where there's another Ted Dabney is a co-founder of Atari that almost no one knows exists, because Nolan was such a larger-than-life character, remains such a larger-than-life character. Nolan went on, after starting Atari, to start Chuck E. Cheese. And so this is someone who, you know, like in his mind and actually in his office, had a giant stuffed costume for a creature he called Ricky Rat that eventually became Chuck E. Cheese when someone pointed out that maybe rats in restaurants weren't the best thing to put together. Then this is Larry Emmons, and then on the far right is Al Alcorn, and Al is the person that I focus on in telling the Atari story. I really wanted to focus on Al because he's an engineer, and I think that too often, and he's an engineer who wanted to stay an engineer. I think that it's so easy in the stories about Silicon Valley to get caught up in the business side of the story, the flashy entrepreneur side. Al said he never wanted to be a capitalist pig. He actually was at those People's Park protests, and my story of his work opens with him being there and taking photos and trying to figure out, you know, where does he fit in to this combination world of he's got the long hair, he's got the beard, you can see, you know, what he looked like. At the same time, he wants to be a very straight-laced engineer. How does he kind of get that going? The other thing that I wanted to be sure to tell you about video games is that there's a decent argument to be made that it was video games that taught people how to interact with screens. These people, when people played Pong, it was the first time that you would move something, you know, in this case, a knob, and later joysticks, and things would change on the screen in front of you. And there are hilarious stories, actually, of people calling Atari wanting to know, how does the network know to move the line on the Pong game when I twist the knob? So it's laying the foundation that, you know, we all have, for better or for worse, come to live with. This next person is Sandy Kurtzig, Sandra Kurtzig. Sandy is the first woman to take a tech company public. This is Ask. Ask. This is her software company. And she is, to me, a fascinating character. People always say, did you choose Sandy because she's a woman? And I chose Sandy because she was a software entrepreneur at a time, as I told you, when everyone was building hardware. So you can even, Larry Ellison tells a hilarious story of trying to get Oracle funded and going to around the same times that she's trying to get Ask off the ground. And Larry went to these offices of these different venture capitalists and was just laughed out of the room. People did not understand what software was. People literally would ask computer experts, so how much does the software in your machine weigh? It's still a really hard thing to get your mind around what exactly is software. And Larry Ellison said that the secretaries would check his bag before he left to make sure he didn't have a business week that he'd sort of hidden away, because what he was talking about was so shady. So Sandy is doubly cursed in that she is selling software at a time when everyone's doing hardware, and she is a woman at a time when it's overwhelmingly male in the Valley. And when the entire system is rigged in a way that's really hard for us to understand, it was, I believe, 1974 when a woman was first allowed a credit card in her own name without her husband's permission. And it was 1980 before sexual harassment in the workplace was recognized by the EEOC. And so she, a woman selling software, she says people literally thought she was selling lingerie. And she is a fascinating story, too, because she is someone who came up completely outside of these networks that made Silicon Valley, makes it so easy, relatively speaking, to launch a company in Silicon Valley. She completely bootstrapped her business. Interestingly, even though the typical story is the startup in a garage, she started her company at her kitchen table, and she got a loan from her dad, and she didn't want to take any outside money. She ended up actually, and this is another story that I think a lot of people don't appreciate, is how much the big companies helped the little companies in the Valley early on. As I told you, computers at the time, hundreds of thousands of dollars. There's no way a little startup software company could ever afford one of those. But Hewlett-Packard let these little companies, dozens of these little companies, come in at night and use their computers. And of course, HP had a vested interest in doing that, right? They wanted software for their computers. But at the same time, it really put some sort of a scaffolding under a number of these companies. And I think if there's one thing that I would point to as an underappreciated part of Silicon Valley history, it's this notion of previous generations of either technologists or companies or entrepreneurs succeeding and then turning around and helping the next generation succeed. So Bob Noyce, who I wrote about in my first book, he was from Iowa. He called it restocking the stream I fished from. And Steve Jobs, when he spoke at Stanford in 2005, alluded to this phenomenon as well. He talked about when he was fired from Apple in 1985, and he said he called David Packard, the Packard and Hewlett-Packard, and Bob Noyce, and he said, "I apologized for dropping the baton." And he'd had this sense of there being a relay race, essentially, across generations, where one generation hands off and helps the next and helps the next. I think that's something that we don't quite appreciate enough, and we need to make sure keeps going. We also need to figure out how we can have more than one baton being passed, and how people who previously, like Sandy, we're not even in the running for a baton, you know, can get a baton handed to them too. I mean, it's kind of my secret hope that this book serves as a tiny bit of a baton for people. And the last person I want to talk with you about, who I profile, is Bob Taylor. Does the name Bob Taylor mean anything to anybody in this room? Oh, I love that. 0% recognition. Bob Taylor is the guy who first convinced the Department of Defense to start the ARPANET. So he is the guy who said, we ought to be able to network computers together and get this started, that became the internet. And then for his second act, he moves to California, to Palo Alto, again, because he didn't want to work for the Department of Defense anymore. He was against the Vietnam War. And contrary to mythology, the internet was not started with the idea of surviving a nuclear war. The internet was started because of this notion that we ought to be able to have it so that different types of computers can talk to each other. That's a story. The sort of idealistic philosophy behind that is something that I cover quite a bit in the book. What did happen was that very quickly, in order to justify the existence and continued funding of the ARPANET, they had to start justifying it in terms of defense uses, but that was not the motivation behind it. So that's what he does in 1966. Then he moves to Palo Alto, and he is the guy who runs the legendary computer science lab at Xerox PARC. This is the lab that Steve Jobs famously visited in 1979, where he first saw the mouse, the overlapping, you know, windows. What you see is what you get. When you print something, it looks like what's on the screen. Word processing happening. The things I recently got to see, a video of a demonstration of the technology in this computer, which was called the Alto. They had email going. They had file sharing going. It was incredible. 1977. They had Altos in one was in California and one was in Miami, where they were showing this demonstration. And the person in Miami was controlling the cursor on the computer of the person in California in 1977. So this is the sort of thing that Steve Jobs saw and said, I can do more with that than they're doing at Xerox, which is true. And he incorporated that into the Lisa and then eventually into the Mac. And now when you think about your phone, we're still doing more or less the same thing. We're still using a keyboard. We're still using a pointing device. We're still interacting through a screen. And that was one of Bob Taylor's big insights, is that these printouts that used to be the way that people would see what their computers did was not the way we were going to do it. We're going to do it through screens. And then for Act Three, after Taylor was fired from PARC because he was a wonderful man to work for and a terrible man to have work for you, he went on to DEC, where he worked. His team worked on AltaVista, which was the first great search engine, and they also electronic books. They also kind of continued to be too far ahead of everyone else. And I'll just end with a picture of the meeting room at Xerox PARC. These guys, I can't remember, is there a woman in this picture? Yes, yes. There were women inside Xerox PARC. This was an important thing to that lab. These are researchers in the room, in the beanbag chairs, for the one and only meeting that Taylor insisted that they hold, which was on Tuesdays. You had to be there for what were called dealer meetings, where the researchers would talk about what they were up to. And Taylor had a master's degree in psychology, and he was running a lab so full of brilliant PhD computer scientists that the president of MIT publicly worried about the future of computer science education in the United States, because everyone that he wanted and everyone he hoped to see at the top universities, they were all in Taylor's lab. Top people who are now at Stanford, Carnegie Mellon, the two people who founded Adobe, they worked for Taylor. The guy who moved to Microsoft and wrote Microsoft Word worked for Taylor. And you know that technology going into Apple. It was incredible what he was able to get this team to do. And he liked to say that none of us is as smart as all of us. And I think that's a great point to end on. Thank you.
Please,
and we're going to go into Q&A,
and
right?
Thank Dr. Berlin for sharing her valuable insights. We would like to remind our listening audience, this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. We now open the floor for questions. Please keep your questions short and concise. You can line up right behind me and get going here. So, sir, please say your name and then ask your question.
My name is Jerry Levine. I was written about in your first book.
Yes, I remember.
I'd like to testify that her research was impeccable, unbelievably thorough, extremely well written, and had a major impact on all of us who were there. And we're very grateful for that. Your presentation tonight is an illustration of your capabilities in speaking as well as in learning and writing and researching. That's my most important message. But with your permission, I'd like to make a few quotes from your original book, yes, which I think are very relevant. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm used to speaking without one. Okay, so here's what I'd like to say. I'd like to quote a few things from your book. The Valley got its name from Fairchild Semiconductor, whose CEO, Bob Noyce, helped to introduce silicon wafers to the industry. You wrote in May 1962 that Noyce's assistant, Jerry Levine, that's me, who had a penchant for travel and a nose for business, cashed in 3 years accumulated vacation days and paid his own way to Hong Kong because he thought Fairchild could build an assembly plant there. Levine had been talking about this for months. Labor costs were low in Asia, a dollar a day, and the workforce was capable of assembling transistors. Today, labor costs in Hong Kong minimum are $35 a day, up from a dollar. Nearly everyone who heard my idea thought he was crazy. Noyce did not see why the idea should not work. He was the hero. He wrote to himself, "It's my ball." And he, 1 month later, he sent two officers to Hong Kong who returned to support the idea, Charlie Spork and I've forgotten the other. In January 1964, the proposal was submitted to the parent board in New York and were, quote, practically thrown out of the room. Fairchild persevered, and by 1965, silicon wafers were shipped to Hong Kong, and in 1968, Fairchild had 4,000 employees outside the U.S. in 145,000 square feet. We had been a tiny company. Production had increased 500 times in 5 years, and such output from 32 U.S. firms outside of the U.S. was 75% of all U.S. semiconductor production overseas. So that's the story. You helped make it happen. I'm here tonight to thank you for your part.
Well, thank you. And I really want, well, thanks. Something that I'm really glad you pointed to there. Noyce is the perfect example of someone who lived in the spotlight. And Noyce, more than almost anyone, deserved to live in the spotlight. Noyce co-invented the microchip and co-founded Fairchild and co-founded Intel and was an important mentor to Steve Jobs, among other people. So, I mean, anyone deserves to be in the spotlight. It would be Noyce. But he always had the same this exact same attitude of it being the team that mattered. And when people ask me, you know, why is it that you chose to write about people who aren't necessarily well known? And actually, I tell this story in the book. I was at a party with the COO of a company with a very famous celebrity CEO. And that COO was singing a little song. And the only words were, "I did all the work. He got all the credit." And I think that for the best leaders, they don't take all the credit. They often get a lot of attention shined on them. And the analogy that I like to use actually is of a pitcher who has just thrown a perfect baseball game, in that if you're at the game, you know that the outfield was just going crazy making these catches, and the first baseman is just killing himself to step on the bag, and the catcher's making, you know, the perfectly calibrated call. But all that goes in the record books is that the pitcher threw a perfect game. And I really think that tech innovation is really a team sport. And that's something that I'm glad you were able to point out, where someone has an idea and other people build on it. Yeah.
Dr. Berlin, thank you very much for a bit of a walk down memory lane for me. I came to California and was working in Silicon Valley when there were prune vines on Prune Yard in Cupertino. So a lot of this resonates. The question I have is, actually an opinion from you would be helpful. Over the years, many states and governments have come to Silicon Valley to figure out what the magic is so they could repeat it. You know all of the examples as well. So, and as I listen to your story, it sounds like it's a bit of an odd coincidence that all of this came together, that you really couldn't plan it in advance. But looking at it in hindsight, it looks like it's brilliance. So I'd like to hear from you how repeatable you think this is for all of these combinations to come together.
Yeah, that's a great question. And people are constantly trying to figure out how do we build the next Silicon Valley. And I mean, I think the first thing I would point out is at this point, there are a lot of really important tech regions all over the world. And of course, you know, the most obvious one nearby is Seattle, right? I mean, these are everywhere. I think that Silicon Valley was came to exist in a period that was very historically specific. I mean, you had this strange phenomenon of a place that basically had very little business infrastructure. A technology appears, and it's got to be one of the most sort of vital technologies ever to show up, namely the transistor in 1956, which you can think of as like a grain of sand inside of a pearl. Just layer after layer after layer after layer has been built. If you take apart any of this stuff that we use today, and you're going to find transistors way down in there, and you drop this technology into a place that has essentially no business infrastructure on. And you're able to build like this bespoke culture, this bespoke environment around it. And that was vital. I think that an equally interesting question is, why is Silicon Valley still going? Because if you think about it, we've gone from instruments to chips to the time period I'm talking about, which is sort of consumer tech and also biotech. And we, of course, have had networking and the web and the cloud and social and Tesla, you know, cars. I mean, so the interesting question is, why has it continued? And I think the fact that we have at this point such a finely tuned machine plays a lot of a role. The handoff, the baton passing plays an important role. But the third thing that I would really, really point to is the role of immigrants in the Valley. At this point, two-thirds of the people working in science and tech, two-thirds in Silicon Valley, were born outside of the United States. And more than half of the unicorn companies, the privately held companies with valuations of $1 billion or more, have at least one founder born outside of the United States, and 70% of them have a foreign-born employee in a key role. And Silicon Valley has always had an influx, and much more so than other parts of the country, of people from elsewhere. The story that I'm telling, these are people coming from other parts of the country, but very quickly, they are coming from all over the world. And this has really served as this incredible refresh button in the system, where you have this mixing of ideas from everywhere, and the best and the brightest coming here to do this work. And so whenever people ask me sort of what is the biggest threat to Silicon Valley or to the sort of American tech dominance, I I always say it's screwing down the nozzle on immigration, because no country has a lock on smart, motivated, hardworking people. And so if this ceases to be the place that people want to come, there are so many other places that would take them. And then to couple that with cuts to public education is just like flat out insane.
On Michael Krasny this morning, there was a guy talking about Silicon Valley. And one thing he pointed out was that because of the large amount of capital that Google and Apple have, that innovation just gets bought up by these people. Every new idea, as soon as they think it's good, they buy it up. So can you talk about the impact of that in terms of diversity and growth in the Valley if just a few companies have such a large amount of capital and can suck up everything?
Yeah, I think that this really points to what I was talking about earlier, which is that we're seeing something new in the Valley and in the public's attitudes towards the Valley, because from the beginning, people have been expecting that Silicon Valley is on the brink of dying. So, I mean, you literally can go back to the 1960s and 70s and see people complaining about traffic and housing costs. And that was going to kill Silicon Valley. The oil shocks were going to kill Silicon Valley. The Japanese competition was going to, Chinese and Indian competition was going to, Y2K was going to, the dot-com bust was going to kill Silicon Valley. All these things were going to kill Silicon Valley. But no one ever really seemed to think, maybe someone needs to be cutting Silicon Valley down to size a little bit. There was always the notion that Silicon Valley was sort of the golden child of the golden state, and we were going to be the source of American economic power. And what we're seeing now are some very legitimate concerns. This is one, the question of how can, you know, these companies, they get bought. This is problematic. Another point that people have made is that in some sense, these companies are acting effectively as utilities. So you take something like Facebook, for example, where in order to reach your public, a lot of these startups pretty much have no choice but to advertise on Facebook. And some people are arguing that these companies now need to be regulated as some form of a utility or as some form of a media company. They're too big for the left to be happy. They're too left-leaning for the right to be happy. And so we're really at a point where I don't know what is going to happen here. I mean, this is the beauty of being a historian, is you don't have to predict the future. I do think that one solution just has to, we need more transparency. I mean, we need to understand better what is happening to the information we provide, and we need as consumers to be responsible in our decision-making about what sort of information we provide. I don't know how many of you saw the really interesting article by Stephen Johnson in this last Sunday New York Times magazine about the promise of blockchain technology as a way of kind of getting around this concentration of power. If you haven't looked at it, it has the word Bitcoin in the title, but don't let that scare you or make you hold your nose. It's actually a really interesting sort of article. So I think that we have to try to figure out what are the guardrails that we need and to force those to be put up. But I really don't know what's going to happen. I just know that we are having problems. I would also point out, however, that these big companies that are buying up these little companies are also the source of a lot of little companies. Because a lot of people leave them to start their own companies, and a lot of people make a lot of money at them and turn around and fund little companies. So it's not a completely dark picture.
This is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Now for our last question.
To build on the point that you're making, and also early in your presentation, you mentioned the role of the government in sparking Silicon Valley's key ideas and the growth. Today, we certainly are seeing the flip side of the story from various critics, appropriately so in most cases, but sometimes uncritically so. So this week, Mark Benioff talked about Silicon Valley's management style needs to change. And he was, I think, referring to taking more responsibility for things like uncontrolled bots and fake news and affecting election results and so forth. The argument over the last year has been around the pros and cons of AI and so forth. Question to you is basically, to the degree that there are laws for the physical world that apply for all of the physical activities, such as the Federal Communications Commission's rules, the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Election Commission, on and on and on. And in the broadcast world, there's standards for news. To what degree do you think Silicon Valley will need to be recognized that they will need to accept some of those same rules for their governance?
Well, I think that we're seeing a real test case of this in Europe, right, where they are ahead of us on exactly these sorts of issues, and particularly on the privacy front. And so I think that they have been willing to play by those rules in other countries. It's interesting. I was talking to two guys from the Netherlands, and they were saying it's very easy to regulate companies that aren't your own. They were saying if you look at Volkswagen, for example, and the difference between the fines that were imposed by the United States in the wake of the scandals and what happened in Europe, there's no comparison. And so this, I think it is going to be harder to impose those sorts of regulations when it's American jobs and American people who are going to be affected, but it is something that's going to get played out.
Again, join me in thanking Dr. Berlin on a fabulous presentation. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you.